Roshi's words. To renounce things doesn't mean to get rid of them. It means to accept that they go away. We've had some practice in that the last couple of years. And it seems like we're still there. We don't know what the pandemic will do next. We don't know what climate change will do next. We don't know what the dictators of the world will do next. So those are the kinds of things I was thinking of when I chose the title. And yet, yesterday, I thought of someone that I knew 50 years ago and decided to see if I could find them. So, you know, I typed their name into an internet search engine. And I found both of them, Chuck and Shelley, on the prayer list at a certain church in Pennsylvania. So I went, So I sent an email to the church and wondered if it was possible to contact them. And of course, the prayer list told me that something was going on. But what I learned is that these people who I knew in their 20s, young, enthusiastic, and vigorous, well, Chuck had a stroke, and Shelley has advanced dementia, and they're living in a nursing home. That's the thing that I don't think about when I say things go away. I spend all my time preparing to live without the grid, or wondering what will happen when food shortages get serious. But these ordinary things are the ones we always have to remember. So, so that changed this talk, and I haven't called yet, but I will. One of the things that happens when you live for a while is that things change both in the people around you and in your own body. And I've been lucky, but they weren't. Or maybe they were, who knows what he'll say. So then I did a great deal of thinking about things that are happening in the world and how we got here. And I'm not sure that's what I need to talk about. I think I'm going to go to Dogen. I'll say when things are difficult, however that is, when things go away, there's something that we can do and that our practice does. Thich Nhat Hanh wrote about the refugees in small boats from Vietnam. And of course, my notes are also unreliable. It's right there. When the crowded Vietnamese refugee boats met with storms of pirates, if everyone panicked, all would be lost. If even one person on the boat remained calm and centered, it was enough. It showed the way for everyone to survive. So, Dogen writes, in Body and Mind Study of the Way, everyday mind means to maintain an everyday mind in this world or in any world. Yesterday goes forth from this moment, and today comes forth from this place. With going, the boundless sky goes. With coming, the entire earth comes. This is everyday mind. Everyday mind opens the gate of the inner chamber, because thousands of gates and myriads of doors open and close all at once. It is everyday mind. Now this boundless sky and entire earth are like unrecognized words, a voice from the deep. Words are all-inclusive, mind is all-inclusive, things are all-inclusive. So I guess I'm going to talk about everyday mind. We have a way in this society of making up stories. We make plans. We interpret things. We analyze. We tell the news. We listen to the news. We wonder sometimes, how did this come to be? And is there anything I can do about it? But the mind we have. Margaret Atwood wrote a poem about this mind. And she says, the moment when, after many years of hard work and a long voyage, you stand in the center of your room, house, half acre, square mile, island, country, knowing at last how you got there, and say, I own this. That's the mind. And you've never been in that mind, say, when you graduated, got an award, got a job, published something. I own this. Is the same moment the trees unloose their soft arms from around you. The birds take back their language, the cliffs fissure and collapse. The air moves back from you like a wave and you can't breathe. No, they whisper, you own nothing. You are a visitor time after time, climbing the hill, planting the flag, proclaiming, we never belonged to you, you never found us. It was always the other way around. It's the other way around. They find us, they hold us. And this is where renunciation lies. I started an organization once, and then I went around asking for help from various beings. There were some trees that I asked for help, and some flowers, and some mountains. And one day I was in Hong Kong and I took a walk up a peak, a place where lots of people go to walk. And someone took me to a place where there were old sculptures, carvings in cement. And they were a dragon and a phoenix. And just like a little way away, there was a Buddha. And we spent some time there. And I said to the dragon and the phoenix, would you help me? Would you help me do this? And they said, no. You're nothing. You're just a speck. We have been doing this dance forever. They have been doing this dance forever. All the beings of the universe have been doing this dance. We're just one of them. Each of us is one of them. And each of the bacteria in our bodies is also one of them. And more than half the weight of our bodies, or maybe it's more than half the volume of our bodies, is made up of those bacteria. Those thousands and probably millions of beings that constitute us. So, renunciation of the story. Allowing mind to be every day. And then the inner chamber opens. Although there is birth and death in each moment of this life of birth and death, the body after the final body is never known. then he talks about enlightenment. Enlightenment is not my subject today. Or maybe it is, because it's always the subject. I'll say a little more about this mind. Davi Kopenawa. He's an international environmental leader. He's also a shaman of the Yanomami people in Brazil. When he was a child, an epidemic came and a great many people died, including some of his family members. When he was adult, the gold miners came. The white people continued to build roads and to dig and to mine and to pave things. And finally, as he continued speaking and trying to protect just this place that he lived, he says, "I do not want anything other than the forest and its game, the rivers and the fish, the trees, their fruit, and the wild honey. I want all those so my children and their children will be able to live well after my death." And he says, "The lives of white people who hurry around all day like Jirina ants seem sad to me. They were always impatient and anxious not to get to their job late or be thrown away. They barely sleep and run around all day in a daze. They only talk about working and the money they lack. They live without joy and age rapidly, constantly busying themselves with acquiring new merchandise. Their minds empty. Once their hair is white, they disappear, and the work, which never dies, survives them without end. Then their children and grandchildren continue doing the same thing." That's what we get to renounce. We get to let go of that. And we get to let those beings create us. We get to let our own microbes and the coronavirus and the coral reefs and the jellyfish, and the pine trees, the spruce trees, the oaks, bur oaks, white oaks, red oaks. We get to let them breathe life into us. Zen Master Daji of Baijiang said, "If you attach to the view that original purity and original emancipation are Buddha or Zen practice, you are a follower of the outsider's way of spontaneous enlightenment." Zen is in the spontaneous enlightenment school. We're all already enlightened. Enlightenment is just the way things are. There's nothing to do and nothing to find and nothing to learn. It's just right there, no gaining idea. But he says, "This teaching is not the broken furniture of an abandoned house, but the collected efforts and accumulated virtue of studying the way. The body suddenly leaps up transparently clear in eight directions. It drops away entwined around a tree like wisteria." So there's a matter. What renunciation doesn't mean, it doesn't mean to get rid of things. It also doesn't mean, we might renounce thinking, but it doesn't mean that we won't think. Sometimes people think renunciation just means accept whatever comes. Let it be. Just practice. Just, you know, calm your mind and everything will be okay. And I don't think so. I think that that thing is called escape, not renunciation. I think that renunciation involves engagement. Donna Haraway, well, wrote a whole book, actually, but in this place she was writing about Adolf Eichmann. Now, Adolf Eichmann was a bureaucrat in Nazi Germany. And Haraway writes, "The world does not matter in ordinary thoughtlessness. The hollowed out spaces are all filled with assessing information, determining friends and enemies, and doing busy jobs. Negativity, the hollowing out of such positivity, is missed, an astonishing abandonment of thinking." The result for Eichmann was active participation in genocide. It is important for us to be alert and aware. It is important for us to know that we could die the next moment. And this is true whether we're thinking, I could die in a car crash, or I could be shot, or I could die in a wildfire, a flood, one of all those things that involve natural catastrophe, currently usually known as climate change. We're living in interesting times. We're living in hard times. And I'm going to say much less about that than I meant to. Because what I want to offer is, what do we need? What do we need to live in these times? So this is a poem by Ursula Le Guin. It's titled, "The Marrow." She says, "There was a word inside a stone. I tried to pry it clear, mallet and chisel, pick and gad, until the stone was dropping blood. But still I could not hear the word the stone had said." Seems to me like she knows that thing that Dogen told us about, and that the masters told us about, striving and trying and working to gain the secret. You still don't get it. You don't hear that word. And then she says, "I threw it down beside the road among a thousand stones. And as I turned away, it cried the word aloud within my ear, and the marrow of my bones heard and replied." Although the life of those who abandoned home and entered the homeless realm may appear bleak and lonely, it should not be confused with that of woodcutters. He's making an assumption about woodcutters, but never mind. Even if they are continually active, their life is not the same as that of farmers. Do not get caught up in discussions of delusion or enlightenment, good or bad. Do not stay in the realm of wrong or right, true or false. There is something. I'm trying to find it. It's like all the things I collected to give this talk, they just went away on me. And yet, there is that thing that I was looking for, and it shows up. And it shows up between us, it shows up among us. That is how a talk is always given. Talk is not given from a bunch of paper or something prepared. A talk happens and arises in the room. So, oh, and how long am I supposed to talk to?
9:15, 10:15.
That's good. And then we have discussion. That includes discussion. Okay.
Yes.
All right. In that case, I'll find an ending place. One of the texts that I discovered by surprise, like many years into my practice, was Dogen's Vow. It's called Ehe Koso Hotsugaman. And he says, we vow with all beings from this life on throughout countless lives to hear the true Dharma. That's one thing. How do we hear the Dharma? Well, we can come here and hear it, and we can pick up books and read it. And we can also look at the light of the sun on the trees. That was what I did this morning. I turned off the radio as I drove, and the sunlight was brilliant, and everything was brown and tan, a little yellowish, a little dark brown, because I live in the country, and so what I was driving through was natural things, and oh, the light and shadow on a cornfield that's been cut down, even though it's a sort of unnatural human-made thing. It's still like, oh, the colors. Oh, the shapes of those tree branches. Oh, the water. To hear the true Dharma, it's all around us. And then I came closer into the city, and I started seeing things as ugly. And then I continued driving into the city, and then I started seeing those things as beautiful. There was a bridge. It had, I think, a kind of rust color and some shapes and, again, shadows. And then I drove under it. It would be nice to walk. I would experience them more fully, but that's inconvenient. I think some days about when cars will go away. And I think about how wonderful that will be and how my life will completely not work. How dependent I am on cars. If not mine, somebody else's. And so I make little attempts to prepare for that time. But there we are, things go away. So we vow to hear the true Dharma. That upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us, nor will we lack in faith. Well, there's a challenge. I don't know how often any of you lack in faith. Sometimes I doubt myself. Am I doing the right thing? Shouldn't I be doing this other thing? And sometimes I doubt the people around me. Going to do? Why are they so crazy? And then, of course, after that, I notice how crazy I am. And by crazy, there's a mental illness that's been named and defined, and I'll probably pronounce it wrong, Wetiko is the cannibal sickness, and it takes everything and turns it into, it eats things, but it turns them into poison, and it's contagious, and if you try to fight it, you catch it. And of course, it's the disease of our time. Gross national product is defined as how much of nature did we turn into things so that we can either eat them, use them, or sell them. So that's the crazy that I use. I'm cautious with that word because, you know, there are stigmas around everyone and everything that's not quite what we think is perfect. But what we think is perfect is that thing which I'm saying is crazy, mentally ill. So normal we lack in faith, even at a time when everything around us looks, on the one hand, kind of scary, and the other hand, my life is still working fine. You know, I have enough to eat and I'm warm at night. Nobody's hit me lately. almost never. It's like, and that upon meeting it, we shall renounce worldly affairs and maintain the Buddha Dharma. So I think worldly affairs is another term for that mental illness I'm describing. And that in doing so, the great earth and all living beings together will attain the Buddha way. We're in it with everyone. We are not just quieting our minds. We quiet our minds in order to pay attention to what's happening, in order to have clear action, clear judgments, and wholesome actions. And then there's this wonderful thing at the end where he says, confessing and repenting in this way, one never fails to receive profound help from all Buddhas and ancestors. By revealing and disclosing our lack of faith and practice before the Buddha, we melt away the root of transgressions by the power of our confession and repentance. We receive help. We are not less than those who went before us, nor are we more than them. We are just here, each of us, making our little offering in the grand symphony of all life on earth and life in the universe. But it's plenty big enough to think about life on earth. To maintain the Buddha Dharma is like this. We allow things to be as they are and we engage with them. We do not adopt a position of helplessness. We do not throw away all of our thoughts. We might need them. Somewhere in some kinds of practice, there's a serious temptation to ignore what's going on around us. And I don't hear Dogen proposing that. And I certainly don't propose it. which it's perhaps audacious to follow Dogen's comments with my comments, but there we are because he left us words and we are here in living bodies. One more poem, and then we can talk. She says, infinitive. We make too much history. With or without us, there will be the silence and the rocks and the far shining. But what we need to be is, oh, the small talk of swallows in the evening over dull water under willows. To be, we need to know the river holds the salmon, and the ocean holds the whales as lightly as the body holds the soul. In the present tense. In the present tense. Would anyone like to say anything?
So you just said something like, it seems audacious for me to comment after Dogen. Mm-hmm. And I would like to offer a different perspective. With Dogen, or Shakyamuni Buddha, or with anybody who's come before us, or who comes now, it almost seems audacious to me to not engage with those people. Because when we don't engage, we're not empowering them, or we're not making them alive in our lives. And so to me, in some way, it seems audacious and kind of arrogant to not be involved.
That was beautiful. Thank you for that expression.
I really appreciated what you said about renunciation being not getting rid of something. Because I think the word itself, I mean, our usual understanding of it, renounce, you know, has this sort of energy of like, oh, I renounce Satan and all his minions. Something like that. Mm-hmm. So, and I really liked the image of, so what is it that we're, when we renounce, what is it that we're renouncing? And it seemed like you're bringing up the poem, was it Mary Oliver about the stone? Or Ursula Le Guin,
yeah. I usually do Mary Oliver, but she didn't come today.
About the that there is a certain energy of effort, like trying mm-hmm. to chisel the word out of the stone, but in the end, the renouncing is like, in a way, it's renouncing that grabbing on. So then it's mm-hmm. like just throwing the stone down is mm-hmm. when then it comes. So yeah. I really love that image. That really helps me understand renunciation better. Thank you.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. I thought as I was talking about it, I went, oh, this is like Ananda's enlightenment. You know, he's trying to get enlightened before this conference of all the arhats, and he finally gives up, and they say, as his head hit the pillow, he woke up. Now, of course, they make all these wonderful stories. I mean, they felt no obligation that they were connected with literal physical reality, but it's okay, we can tell them too.
So that poem that you read about by the shaman, or the what the shaman said about white people running around like ants and not sleeping and being busy. So what's like, I'm just thinking, like, what's the alternative to live in this world with balance but not be that ant running around?
Ah, yes. Well, I'll let you know. But I can say words about it. Like, I spend my whole life trying to convince people of things that I'm still trying to experience. So so I can talk about it. Alternative.
When I think about it, it's like the middle way, right?
Right, yeah.
Trying to find
within
that and in this society, like, some type of balance or not being totally caught up in all of the things that are thrown at us.
Yeah, so, this book is titled Arts of Living on a Damaged Planet, by the way. And one of the editors wrote a book, a whole, ethnology, I think it's called, about the people and societies organized around harvesting matsutake mushrooms in Oregon. And this is after a magnificent forest has been clear cut. And there's a different kind of tree that grows up after it. And the matsutake mushrooms grow under those trees. So we're growing in ruins. That's happening in ruins. And then she describes all the people. I mean, matsutake is a very valued mushroom in Japan. So this is all, food for export. And they're the people who gather them. And they're the people who sell them. And they're the people who sell them to market. And they're the people who ship them overseas. And it, it's much richer than that, but that's what I can remember right now. And she said, we survive collaboratively. Everybody does a piece. Everybody does a little piece. I have a friend who is a retired geneticist who says, we are the genetic material of the universe. On the one hand, that's very small, and on the other hand, it's totally, totally essential. Because it puts us in our role of creator. And so, if you go through the day thinking, oh, I'm creating the universe. Not I, but, I create the universe. People, the shaman, lived, they didn't have literacy, and there's a case to be made for the idea of a self, and particularly the idea of a permanent self, arose with literacy. That in an oral culture, well, if somebody is telling a story about something they did, they have to kind of create a self, and then it goes away again. And so people are just fitting into their roles, growing food, raising children, whatever. And I think, sitting practice, and particularly extended sitting practice, helps us to see. We sit there, and our ideas of ourselves just keep coming up and coming up and coming up. And eventually they get kind of tiresome. And eventually also you come down some. And so there's calming down, and then there's going, oh, it's not like this. This is how it's working. And that looking, this is how it's working inside, is a starting place. And then you start going, okay, and in this one relationship, how is it working? How is it that I get angry when they say X? How is it that they feel happy when I say Y? or when I do why. That is just, because the only thing that exists is interaction. Nothing is solid at all. And so it's like stepping back and noticing that things aren't solid, and then supporting that stepping back with a sitting practice and with mindfulness practices and everything else that we call formal practice. That's what I can offer at this moment.
Thank you, Shona.
Hey.